So on January 13, 2012, the cruise ship Costa Concordia left its port in Italy for a week-long cruise around the Mediterranean. As the Concordia approached this little Tuscan island of Giglio several hours later, it deviated from its standard course in order to give a maritime salute. It's a very common practice, and the captain of the Concordia has done this several times. However, the area around this little island is known for its rock outcroppings. And at some point in their journey, they noticed one of those outcroppings in the path of the ship. So the captain did the right thing. He ordered a change of course. But there was language issues, and the helmsman steered the boat in the wrong direction. Well, as you can imagine, that kind of caused some stir on the bridge. And it reportedly took 13 seconds to correct the maneuver. The boat's bow ultimately cleared the reef, but the stern, unfortunately, did not. Because of the confusion on the bridge and all the conflicting orders, the damage was done. The Concordia's port side, or the left side of the ship, suffered a 174-foot tear in the hull. That hidden reef caused catastrophic damage. It sank the ship. More technically, it just flipped it on its side. But 32 people lost their lives. And to give you an idea of the damage in 13 seconds, from this wall to that wall, and then almost double it, is 174 feet. And it did that much damage in 13 seconds. Well, there's another famous shipwreck that we're familiar with, and you're probably already thinking about it. It happened 108 years ago. And it's the Titanic, when it hit an iceberg. And over 1,500 people lost their lives in that disaster. So these two examples, a little over 100 years apart from each other, show that catastrophic damage that can be caused by those hidden dangers in the water. Yet both of these examples show us that the captains knew these dangers existed. They'd been warned by other people who had gone before them. They also knew these things from their own experiences. But yet they still failed to steer clear of areas known for hidden reefs and icebergs. In fact, both accounts kind of hint of reckless behaviors that contributed to these disasters. Well, Jude, in verses 12 and 13, continues to describe apostates and false teachers and the hidden dangers that come along with them. Jude speaks of the lack of fear, and then he also uses several vivid metaphors to further describe what these apostates are like. What Jude is doing is he's warning the church, not just then in his day, but he's warning us as well of these hidden dangers so we can avoid them and avoid the devastating results that will come from them. And so we ought to heed the warning. So, I only have one point this morning, which you probably think, yay, but it comes with five observations. And so, that point, though, is also our title of the message, Hidden Dangers Lead to Catastrophic Results. So, let's look together at verse 12, or the first half of verse 12. These spots, or hidden reefs, in your love feast, while they feast with you without fear, serving only themselves. So our very first observation is to be on the lookout for hidden dangers. So this short sentence just has a tremendous amount of things packed in it. The first thing we see is that Jude calls the apostates spots or hidden reefs. And Jude is once again picking up what Peter said in his second epistle in chapter 2, and as we talked about in the past, 2 Peter 2 and Jude are step with one another. And both Peter and Jude use two different Greek words for spot. They're similar to one another, but they do have different meanings. Peter, for example, uses the words spelos, which means a spot or stain. So what Peter is talking about there is a character flaw. So let's listen to what Peter says. They are spots and blemishes, carousing in their own deceptions while they feast with you. having eyes full of adultery and that cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, they have a heart trained in covetous practices and are accursed children. They have forsaken the right way and gone astray." So Peter has some pretty strong words for apostates and false teachers. Well, Jude uses the Greek word spelos, which means rock or reef over which the sea crashes, or as already mentioned, a hidden reef. And that's a metaphor of men whose conduct is a danger to others. So the false teachers are defiled, and their character flaws can be seen on the surface, but they hide the most dangerous parts of their character underneath the surface, and that is what causes the greatest damage. And Elder Barnes, in his commentary on Jude, says this: "False teachers were as dangerous in the church as hidden rocks are in the ocean." And we know that they're still a danger even in our day. So failure for us to respond decisively and correctly to the warnings of hidden dangers is playing with fire, and it will likely result in catastrophic damage to individuals and to a church in its entirety. Again, we are to be on the lookout for danger. A second observation that we see is we shouldn't allow the culture to influence the church. Jude says that these apostates are spots in your love feasts, or as the King James translates it, your feasts of charity. The word for love here is agape, and you all know what agape means. It's the kind of love that someone would even give their life for somebody else. It's just the strongest form of love that the Greek language has, and you know this. You've heard us mention this in the past. We can't say for certain, but the vast majority of commentators that I read believe that Jude's mentioning of love feasts is most likely a reference to the Lord's Supper. And the use of the word agape here kind of provides a strong argument for that very thing. See, in Jude's day, it was a common custom for the pagan religions to have a festival or a feast that would be held before or after a celebration of a sacrifice. Since the Lord's Supper is celebrating Christ's sacrifice for us, and since Jude's letter was written to Jewish believers, it's really not a stretch to think that there could have been a festival introduced around the Lord's Supper. Although there is no evidence that the apostles had even approved or sanctioned them. And here's why. The Lord's Supper is a holy ordinance of the church, and it's not to be participated in lightly. The apostles understood that these festivals lent themselves to being abused by those that were pretending to be believers. And these pretenders had often hijacked these love feasts for their own benefit. So if Jude is primarily thinking of the Lord's Supper here, then we should consider Paul's warning regarding the observance of the Lord's Supper that we see in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Beginning in verse 27, Paul writes, "Therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord." He continues in verse 29, "For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. For this reason, many are weak and sick among you, and many sleep." So notice what Paul says about participating in the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner. He says that that person eats and drinks judgment upon themselves. They will be weak, sick, and many will die, which is what Paul meant when he said many sleep. So this is something that we should seriously consider every time we approach the Lord's Supper. So again, we must guard against the prevailing culture infiltrating the church. Paul's warning connects us, though, to our third observation this morning. And it gives us, again, another strong reason to think that Jude is more than likely speaking about the Lord's Supper here. And observation number three is this: the apostate has no fear of God. And I will just say up front, of all the observations I'm going to point out to you this morning, this one is probably the most important. Jude says in verse 12 that they feast with you without fear. And this phrase, without fear, is very important to understand. So it asks the question, what are the false teachers and apostates afraid of? Well, there are two possibilities. They have no fear of God, either of His presence or His judgments, or they have no fear of the church. I would argue both. The fear of God or the fear of the Lord is very important to define, and the Bible has a lot to say about the fear of the Lord. We don't have the time to go into such an exhaustive study, so we're going to look at three aspects of it. It's obedience, wisdom, and worship. So the first thing, obedience. The fear of the Lord begins with obedience. And we see this from the very beginning. In Genesis, God told Adam and Eve, you can eat from any tree of the garden except one, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And because Adam and Eve failed and ate from that tree, sin entered into the world. And sin shows that we have a flaw or a lack of the fear of the Lord. Furthermore, in Deuteronomy 10:12, God commands us to fear Him. What does the Lord your God require of you but to fear your God, to walk in all His ways and to love Him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul? And Ecclesiastes 12:13 says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments. So the fear of the Lord is a command, and that first test is always going to be obedience. We not only need to understand what's expected of us from the command that is given, but we also need to do what is commanded. In other words, what James exhorts us in his book, don't just be hearers of the word only, but doers. I think John Bunyan really sums this up quite succinctly when he says, and quote, it is not our knowledge of the will of God, but our sincere complying therewith that proves we fear the Lord, unquote. The second thing is wisdom, knowledge and understanding. A very familiar verse, Proverbs 1:7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. We all know that. But Isaiah gives us something else. He gives us a model to follow. So in Isaiah chapter 11, verses 2 and 3, he is speaking of the Messiah. He's speaking of Christ. And this is what he says. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. His delight is in the fear of the Lord. So we know the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and it grows out from there. True knowledge and understanding and wisdom come from the Messiah, as the Isaiah passage shows us. We as believers will find our wisdom and knowledge in Christ. Paul in Colossians 2:3 refers to Christ as the one in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And then the third thing that we see of a healthy fear of the Lord is it will drive the believer to authentic worship. To have a proper fear of the Lord is to recognize that God is holy, He is powerful, and He is awesome. We have to recognize that God is not like us. Jesus' encounter with the woman at the well is a really great lesson of authentic worship. And we read of this interaction with in John 4, 1 through 26. Just a quick recap. Jesus is on a trip, and he's tired from his journey, and he's going through Samaria, so he stops at a well sometime about the noon hour. And a Samaritan woman shows up to draw water. And so Jesus asks her for a drink. And then this lengthy conversation begins. Well, towards the end of that conversation, the topic of worship comes up. So this is what the Samaritan woman said to Jesus. She goes, sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me. The hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming," and pay attention to these three words because they're very important. "But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship Him. God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship in spirit and in truth." So Jesus tells us very specifically here what authentic worship is. True worshipers or authentic worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. Jesus is changing the understanding of what true and authentic worship is right here. And the reason why is because He's now come. So worship is no longer going to be limited to a location, specifically the temple in Jerusalem. It's not going to be limited to a style or a certain form. These are all secondary matters now that, you know, can be considered, but they're not primary. Christ's statement of "and now is" in verse 23 forever alters how believers are to worship God. We're no longer, as I said, required to go to the temple or to go through a priest or go through a sacrificial system. When Christ died on the cross, He rent the veil in two of the temple. And what that did is that gave us access, all believers, access themselves to God the Father. That's how we worship in spirit. But worship begins and ends with Jesus Christ. Because Jesus is God, He is the temple where we encounter Him. But we're also to worship in truth, or better stated, by revealed truth. The truth that comes from God and His Word. We are to know His Word. And the more we do, the more we study, the more we allow the Spirit to speak to us through the Word, the more authentic our worship is going to become, and the greater our fear of the Lord is going to fill our lives. We should always consider what our primary purpose is in this life. You know, if you turn on the TV and watch TV shows, or you hear on the news from time to time, or social media, people are always asking, "Now, I don't know what my purpose is." Well, we know what our purpose is. The Bible tells us the reason why we exist, and to put a fine point on it, is to worship and glorify God. Every man, woman, and child is to worship and glorify God, and every man, woman, and child will. You either will surrender your life to Christ in this life and worship Him as a believer, or one day you're going to face Him in the judgment and you will worship Him and glorify Him in judgment. John Calvin wrote this: "We should consider it a great end of our existence to be found numbered among the worshipers of God." So to summarize again, the three aspects of the fear of the Lord are obedience, wisdom, and worship. Now we're going to focus our attention back on verse 12. So look with me at verse 12 again. "These are spots in your love feast, while they feast with you without fear, serving only themselves." Jude is also exhorting the church here because of the apostates having no fear of God before their eyes. And as a result, these apostates didn't fear the church. The church didn't seem to be challenging them. So in other words, if the church fails to challenge and call out false teachers and apostates, then it's going to allow them to carry on and to serve their own self-interest. And this ultimately harms the church, and it will reduce the church's effectiveness. Again, Calvin states this in his commentary on Jude: "I wish there were more judgment in some good men who, by seeking to be extremely kind to wicked men, bring great damage to the whole church." And again, this drives us back kind of to Jude's theme of this letter, which is to continually contend earnestly for the faith. Our fourth observation is this: that there are no concerns for others. So this last phrase, serving only themselves, or as the ESV and King James translate it, feeding themselves, explains just how self-centered false teachers and apostates are. They had no concern for others. They had no concern for the poor. They had no proper reverence for God in any way, and no concern about Christ's sacrifice. They're what Matthew Henry refers to as errant gluttons. They're only out to satisfy their own appetites. And if we're not careful as believers, we can be just as guilty as the apostates and find that we're only feeding ourselves instead of each other. In fact, Jesus felt it was pretty important to warn his disciples about excess. This is what he told his disciples in Luke 21. He says, "But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that day, meaning judgment day, come upon you unexpectedly." And our fifth observation this morning is Jude's warning of final judgment. So observation number five, apostates are devoid of any real substance and destined for hell. So Jude now describes these apostates using four vivid word pictures. So let's pick it up in the second half of verse 12 and 13, where Jude says, "They are clouds without water, carried about by the winds, late autumn trees without fruit, twice dead, pulled up by the roots, raging waves of the sea, foaming up their own shame, wandering stars for whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever." So Jude is again returning to the subject of judgment, a subject that he spoke about earlier in verses 5 through 7. And the first thing Jude refers to these people as is clouds without water. They're empty. They have nothing of value to provide. It's like the farmer that steps outside. His crops need water. He looks up. He sees all these nice dark clouds that look like they're ready to just drop a ton of rain. But it doesn't rain. In fact, all he sees is the clouds just moving across the sky. And so Jude is likening the apostate to these clouds just being carried along by the current prevailing wind. They might look cool, but that's all. They never deliver cool, refreshing rain. And then Jude refers to them as autumn trees without fruit, twice dead and pulled up by the roots. Now, when I think of autumn, I think of beautifully colored leaves and trees going into this dormant state until they burst forth with vibrant life again in the spring. However, Jude's illustration is really talking about a tree at the end of its life. Well, actually, in fact, a dead tree. He says they have no fruit and that they're twice dead. A dead tree, it can't produce any fruit. And Jesus said, "We will know them by their fruit." So if there's no fruit, it tells you something. But Jude goes even a little further. He says they're twice dead. What Jude is describing here is an unconverted person, somebody who's not saved. We know from Ephesians that says that we are dead in our transgressions and sins. So we're born spiritually dead. So we're dead right out of the gate from a spiritual perspective. And then when we die physically, that's what it means to die twice. So what do you do with dead trees? Well, you cut them down and you throw them in the fire. Jude describes it as being pulled up by the roots. And this image kind of draws my mind to what Christ said in Matthew chapter 3, where we read, "And even now the axe is laid to the root of the trees. Therefore, every tree which does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire." In other words, what Jude is saying is that false teachers and apostates are going to be destroyed. And this is exactly what we learned when we looked at verse 4 several months ago, where we read that these apostates are marked out for condemnation or destruction. Well, Jude moves on to say that these men are like raging waves of the sea, foaming up their own shame. What an image that is. Now, I would imagine Jude is thinking about the Sea of Galilee here. I mean, it's known for its violent storms that can just come up in a heartbeat. But have you seen the ocean when it's worked up from a storm, particularly a hurricane? It's angry, it's violent, it's foamy, and it tends to deposit all sorts of trash on the beach. What Jude is really saying is that these men are out of control. And then Jude finally calls them wandering stars for whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. So he's foretelling the apostate's eternal destination. The phrase wandering stars refers to planets which are unreliable for navigation. And the reason why is because planets orbit around the sun. Thus, if you use a planet at night to navigate, you're going to find yourself lost in the darkness. If you want to navigate successfully at night and you don't have a GPS, you need to use stars because they're fixed bodies of light. But the key word here is reserved. The word reserved is Greek for terejo, meaning to guard, detain, or to keep by military force. And Peter uses the same word in his epistle where he wrote that they're marked or reserved for destruction. So the apostate's eternal reservation is in hell, a place of utter darkness and suffering, or as Wayne Grudem states it, consciousness of punishment. But you know, Jesus spoke a lot about hell. If you read through the Gospels, you'll notice that. And Jesus describes hell, and I want to just give you four descriptions that Jesus used. The first is outer darkness. The second is eternal fire. The third is eternal punishment. And then the fourth is unquenchable fire. So God takes the sin of apostasy very seriously. And God rightly expects all men to have a correct fear or reverence and awe of Him. This is a sobering conclusion to these two verses. The fear of the Lord is a profoundly serious matter. Unbelievers have no fear of God before their eyes. And judgment is coming. And that judgment will be final, and there'll be no appeal. The opportunity to appeal, if you will, is this life, by responding to the gospel and surrendering your life to Christ. If you fail to do that, you're going to stand before the great white throne judgment. God is going to judge, and it will be a done deal. So in conclusion this morning, the fear of the Lord helps us to avoid the hidden reefs that will make shipwreck of our lives. Don't be like the captain of the Costa Concordia that decided that it would be a good idea to deviate from the standard course or the safe course and drift into dangerous territory for no other reason than just to show off. Rather, we need to stay the course that has been mapped out for our lives by Jesus Christ. Even though the road we may walk can be difficult, Christ has already gone before us, and He goes with us. There are wonderful blessings for the one who fears the Lord. And so I thought this morning I would close with these words from Psalm 103, verses 11 through 18. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is His steadfast love to those who fear Him. As far as the east is from the west, so far does He remove our transgressions from us. As a father shows compassion to his children, so the Lord shows compassion to those who fear Him. For He knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. As for man, his days are like grass. He flourishes like a flower of the field, for the wind passes over it and it is gone, and its place knows it no more. But the steadfast love of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear Him, and His righteousness to children's children, to those who keep His covenant and remember to do His commandments. Some wonderful blessings if we fear the Lord. Amen.